This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's Tuesday, March 19th. Donald Trump's lawyers say he doesn't have the money. We start here. Trump's legal team admits the former president can't raise enough cash to post bond.
He casts himself off as a billionaire who wrote The Art of the Deal. And now his lawyers are conceding he can't make a deal.
We'll walk you through his options and if Trump's assets could be seized. Did the Biden White House censor social media during COVID?
I just can't imagine the federal government doing that to them, but maybe I'm naive.
The Supreme Court weighs the difference between government persuasion and coercion. And as Israel targets Gaza's biggest hospital.
When they see us, when we approach them, you can see the smile in their face.
Our team goes inside a flying hospital, evacuating injured Palestinians. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Elizabeth Schulze. Hey, Brad's off today. I'm here again to take you through the news. And we're going to start with a big development in the legal and financial situation of Donald Trump. Trump's legal team is now saying that the former president and Republican presidential nominee is strapped for cash. Just a week ago, Trump had to secure a $91 million bond as he appeals the judgment in the E. Jean Carroll case. It's a typical part of the legal process to obtain a bond as you appeal a civil court judgment. Basically, you're securing a guarantee that you'll be able to put forward the amount of money you owe as you wait for the appeals process to play out. These bonds often come from an outside party, like an insurer. And the hope is that you might never have to actually pay the full amount of the judgment if your appeal is successful. Well, Trump was trying to do the same thing in another civil case, where a judge determined he owed $454 million. But as we learned yesterday, he ran into some trouble. Let's bring in ABC's senior investigative correspondent, Aaron Kuturski. Aaron, first of all, which case is this? Just remind us why Trump is on the hook for nearly $500 million as part of this judgment.
This is the New York Attorney General's civil lawsuit against Donald Trump that alleged that he conducted a decade's worth of business with fraudulent financial statements that overvalued assets in his real estate portfolio and therefore hyped up his wealth, perhaps by as much as more than $2 billion.
We are holding him accountable for lying, cheating, and a lack of contrition, and for flouting the rules that all of us must play by.
And he was found liable for that decade's worth of business fraud and ordered to pay a judgment of nearly $500 million when you factor in the interest. And in order to move forward with his appeal, which Trump says he will do and he believes he's going to be successful, he needs to either put all the cash in escrow or post a bond. The problem now is, according to Trump's lawyers in a new court filing, they're saying, Elizabeth, they can't find any surety company willing to underwrite the bond.
Wow.
Trump does not have enough cash to secure it. And his lawyers say they've approached 30 different surety companies and none of them is willing to accept real estate as collateral. And so they're asking an appellate court for permission to post a bond in a lower amount because they say posting something that big is a practical impossibility.
So basically, Trump is trying to get companies to underwrite him here, and they're just saying, sorry, we're not going to do it? Is that why he can't get this bond, Aaron?
His lawyers say they've made diligent efforts to pursue the full amount of the bond, and they say they just haven't been successful.
Hopefully, the whole thing is going to be thrown out in reverse. And if justice is anything in New York State, we'll win.
And so you ask, well, if he needs more cash, why not sell some of his real estate? Because that's one of the things that surety companies are looking for. They're loath to accept real estate because it's difficult to convert buildings into cash quickly. So they want to make sure that there's cash available should Trump lose his appeal and be forced to pay. So why doesn't Trump sell a building, take the cash, secure the bond? And his attorneys say that if Trump wins his appeal, if his appeal is successful, his losses would be irrecoverable. He can't get the building back once he sells it, so he doesn't want to do that. But if he doesn't post a bond, then the New York Attorney General can move to start seizing his assets.
If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets.
And when we spoke with Attorney General Letitia James last month, she told us, Elizabeth, that she is perfectly willing to go to the court and try to do that.
No one is above the law, including former presidents.
Of course, that would be an incredible process to have a state seizing the assets of a former president who is running again. But she says she's willing to try and do it if necessary.
So does this all mean that Trump just really does not have a lot of money besides what's tied up in his real estate? Like, he's not as wealthy and successful as he tries to project.
And that was what was at the crux of the civil case, wasn't it? That he casts himself off as a billionaire and says his net worth is $1, $2, $3, $4, $5, $6, $7 billion, whatever it is. And the whole crux of the case was you can't rely on anything that Trump's saying his wealth is, at least on paper, because the financial statements are fraudulent. And the real estate isn't worth what Trump says it's worth. Well, Trump would tell you that valuing real estate is subjective, and that he could sell properties like Mar-a-Lago for untold billions of dollars. Not that it's for sale, but it's a real dispute about what Trump is actually worth compared to what he says he's worth. But here, he seems to be struggling with how to come up with appropriate collateral, such that his attorneys are now asking a court's permission to post a smaller bond, if any at all. You know, in an ideal world to Trump, there would be no need for a bond because he's so wealthy.
Right.
But according to the Attorney General's office, you can't trust anything Trump says when it comes to his wealth.
Right. Of course, that's extraordinary because Trump is now heading into full campaign mode in the general election. What does it mean for his campaign, Aaron, that he's really running so low on cash?
I think there are two considerations here. One is practical. We know that in 2023, he spent $50 million on legal fees. And he had raised that money from donors, spent it on legal fees. And those fees are only going to mount in 2024 as he faces four different criminal prosecutions. He's in and out of four different criminal courtrooms with tables full of lawyers. And that's going to be costly. And we know that he is facing a fundraising deficit compared to President Biden's campaign operation. I think the other consideration is one of messaging. He casts himself off as a billionaire who wrote the art of the deal. And now his lawyers are conceding he can't make a deal when it comes to paying his bond.
Right. Those $50 million in legal fees last year were paid for by Trump's political fundraising committee. So his legal battles and the political campaign really are so closely tied together. Aaron Kuczerski, thank you so much for being here to break it all down.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Next up on Start Here, did the federal government try to censor social media during COVID? The Supreme Court weighs in. That's after the break.
With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase.
Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.
Here in Washington, there is a constant battle between social media platforms and the federal government over issues like antitrust, mental health, data privacy, misinformation, you name it. There seems to be a push-pull over when and how much the federal government should intervene with companies like Facebook, or when they should just back off. Well, on Monday, the Supreme Court waded into this debate. Right here with me is ABC senior Washington reporter Devin Dwyer, who covers the court. Devin, I want you to just first kind of break down this case that was in front of the court.
This is a case, Elizabeth, that's all about a conservative campaign against government intervention in the things that we say and post online. The group of two states, Louisiana and Missouri, and five individual users of social media sites, Facebook and Twitter, sued the government after the COVID pandemic and 2020 election, saying that it had improperly leaned on the social media platforms to take down their content, to remove postings about things like vaccines and voting and the like. And two lower courts sided with these plaintiffs, saying that the Biden administration had in fact overstepped its authority, violated the First Amendment, and coerced these private companies to suppress speech, sort of violating a core tenet of our democracy.
When the government persuades a private party not to distribute or promote someone else's speech, that's not censorship. That's persuading a private party to do something that they're lawfully entitled to do.
And what the Supreme Court took up yesterday is whether that restriction against government contact should stand. Can the government be restricted from contacting social media companies over things like public health, election integrity, national security?
Pressuring platforms in back rooms shielded from public view is not using the bully pulpit at all. That's just being a bully.
Conservatives here were saying they should be handcuffed, sidelined in picking up the phone and calling these companies. But the justices seem pretty skeptical of that idea.
Well, and this is interesting because it doesn't seem like in our Constitution there'd be a clear answer on whether the government should pick up the phone and call social media companies. So where did the justices come down on this?
Well, it's a pretty conservative Supreme Court, right? But you might be surprised to have heard yesterday that a majority of the justices were disinclined to restrict the Biden administration and other government officials from at least picking up the phone. This was a debate about persuasion, which would be constitutionally permissible, making the case, flagging some questionable content, and coercion, which would not be permissible, actually forcing, threatening companies to do something the government wants. At the end of the day, Elizabeth, the justices really seem to focus on the consequences of tying the government's hands at all, specifically when it comes to public safety.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that you get doxxed.
Justice Amy Coney Barrett raised the possibility, say, of a doxing scenario when elected officials' information was posted on these sites. She wondered aloud.
The FBI sees these posts and calls the social media outlet, like X, Facebook, whatever, and says, we really encourage you to take these down because these are significantly threatening and we see some people may be responding to them. That's a problem?
Louisiana's Solicitor General said, you know, no, they can't do that. That would be coercive. It would be impermissible with free speech.
Your Honor, so I think, you know, as I say, I'm a purist on the First Amendment. So my answer would be like, yeah, like.
So the FBI can't make, do you know how often the FBI makes those kinds
that's
of calls?
And that's why.
In another moment of debate during the arguments, we heard Ketanji Brown Jackson bring up the possibility of a viral social media video targeting teenagers, encouraging them to jump out of windows.
Is it your view that the government authorities could not declare those circumstances a public emergency and encourage social media platforms to take down the information that is instigating this problem?
Again, the lawyer for these plaintiffs seemed to say no.
I was with you right until that last comment, Your Honor. I think they absolutely can call and say, this is a problem. It's going rampant on your platforms. But the moment that the government tries to use its ability as the government and its stature as the government to pressure them to take it down, that is when you're interfering with third-party speech rights.
Well, the government could counter that trend by putting out factual information, warnings, but said the First Amendment simply doesn't allow the government to lean on companies in this way. It didn't seem to be getting a lot of traction from the justices at the end of the day.
Surprising to hear Ketanji Brown Jackson and Amy Coney Barrett kind of on the same page.
That's right. They don't usually agree.
Who were the outliers? I imagine they weren't all aligned on
Well,
this.
Justice Samuel Alito, one of the most conservative members of this court, was the most sympathetic to the plaintiffs.
There was a concern that Americans were getting their news about the vaccine from these platforms, and the platforms were promoting, not just posting, but promoting bad information.
I understand all that, and I know the objectives were good. But once again, they were also getting their news from the print media and the broadcast media and cable media, and I just can't imagine the federal government doing that to them. But maybe I'm naive. Maybe
he was in disbelief on the bench that there, in his view, was such a close working relationship between the White House and Facebook, that there was essentially, in his view, a hotline. And at one point he said, you know, the White House seemed to treat Facebook like its subordinate.
The White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners. We're on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away.
The conservative viewpoint in behind this case, Elizabeth, is that the government should not be the final arbiter of truth, that we need to have an open marketplace of ideas, that even though the CDC presents the best scientific evidence, say for vaccines, there are some people who simply aren't going to believe that and should be allowed to say as much and post as much online. And so while it may seem, you know, unsavory or unsound to have this sort of information floating around out there, there is a conservative counterpoint that, you know, our Constitution requires, indeed even allows, free speech to be expressed even when it's ugly or unwanted.
What are we looking at as far as the decision here, Devin, and what the implications might be?
This is a blockbuster case, so we're expecting a decision by the end of June, likely at the very end of June when the court finishes its term. But this is a case that could radically redefine how the government interacts with social media companies. We use these companies all the time. They're ubiquitous, right? And the content we see in our feeds is moderated. Their algorithms are constantly sorting it. But this is a case that will decide how much influence the government can have in what we see and read and post online. But it did seem like the Supreme Court yesterday is ultimately going to allow the government to continue these kinds of contacts with social media companies just so long as it's in the persuasive category, not the coercive category, Elizabeth.
Big one to watch. No, you'll be all over it. Thanks so much, Devin.
You bet.
Remember back in November, Al-Shifa Hospital became a central focus of the war in Gaza. The largest hospital in the Gaza Strip was raided by Israeli troops, who claimed Hamas militants were using it as a base for military operations. Scenes of premature babies being evacuated from the hospital quickly became emblematic of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians who've been caught in the middle of the war. Well, yesterday, 4 months later, Israeli troops were back at Al-Shifa for what they called a high-precision raid of the complex. Let's get to ABC's Inez de la Cutera, who's currently on the ground in Jordan. Inez, what do we know about this military operation? This is no longer a functioning medical complex at this point, right?
That's right. So Israeli forces once again attacking the Al-Shifa hospital in northern Gaza. Now, the IDF has long said that Al-Shifa is being used by Hamas as a command and control center. They haven't provided any kind of substantial evidence of that. And we understand, according to the IDF spokesman Daniel Hagari, that the IDF did use helicopters to fire at the hospital early Monday morning. So this happened Monday at dawn. And then they actually raided the compound. So they say they've arrested more than 200 terrorist suspects and have killed 20 terrorists. The activity there continued through the night. And the IDF says it does plan to continue operating there for the time being. But it's all deeply concerning because, you know, even though, like you say, it wasn't exactly a functioning hospital, there were thousands of civilians who had sought shelter in the hospital. The IDF says they are being allowed to evacuate, but it's still, you know, unclear how many people have left the hospital or may still be trapped there.
Right. And so when we're talking about the civilians, you're actually in Jordan, where there was an airdrop of much needed aid to Gaza that was supposed to happen, but it didn't. I mean, did it not happen because of this hospital raid? What's going on there?
Yeah, so it's unclear, but it's likely that this was linked to everything going on at Al-Shifa. So we were set to board a U.S. C-130 at an airbase in Jordan that had been loaded with, you know, all sorts of humanitarian aid. So rice, pasta, flour, baby formula, diapers. But the all clear for takeoff never came. So the Israelis have to kind of green light these airdrop missions. And at the last minute, the airdrop was canceled. It wasn't just the U.S. flying, I should say. There were a number of other countries involved and kind of different planes that take off and fly at the same time and follow the same flight path. All of that was canceled. We were only told by U.S. forces that it was because the Israelis were conducting some sort of operation in Gaza. Hmm. So again, unclear if that was, you know, what was going on at Al-Shifa. But it's worth pointing out, you know, these aid drops are very difficult.
Well, and as just paint the picture for us for how urgent this aid is right now. I mean, we saw this new report about imminent famine in northern Gaza. I know you've been speaking with civilians, including young children who were evacuated.
Yeah, so we were on an evacuation flight over the weekend from the Gaza border to the UAE. So this was a plane taking children and adult cancer patients from Gaza back to the UAE for additional care. Medics described that as a flying hospital. So, you know, it was set up with everything you'd need to treat patients in flight. So there were beds at the back of the plane, IV drips, ventilators, defibrillators, and we did, you know, speak to a number of injured children there, heartbreaking stories. We met a 13-year-old girl, Yara. She was one of the most severely injured.
Are you in pain right now?
It's just
a little bit.
She was injured in the stomach. She had to undergo 6 hours of reconstructive surgery, and she was being fed by a tube. And the people we spoke with aboard that plane did talk about malnutrition, you know, going hungry in Gaza. Yara was telling us there's no food, no water.
Did you go hungry in Gaza?
There's nothing for people to eat, nothing for people to drink. You know, life is very hard. My baby sister, we can't get her diapers or milk. Everything has become very expensive in Gaza, and that is if we are even able to find it.
Doctors aboard the plane as well, they were saying that malnutrition is one of the big issues they've been seeing recently. You know, kids showing up having lost weight, with iron deficiencies, dehydrated, taking longer to heal because they are malnourished.
And so they come here, I know in the hangar already, but also on the plane, you give them food, you give them water. What's their reaction?
Actually, the thing that you can see when they see us, when we approach them, you can see the smile in their face, that now they feel that they are safe.
Wow. And given that backdrop, we know that President Biden, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, spoke for the first time yesterday. This was the first time in more than a month. Biden had been talking about how they needed to have this come to Jesus moment and talk about this, really, the relentless attacks on civilians. What do we know about that conversation? Does it kind of change that picture when it comes to humanitarian aid, Inez?
Yeah, I mean, I think really interesting that the two spoke. We've seen the divide between the two leaders kind of growing over the last few weeks and months. You know, Israel and the U.S. were very much in lockstep in the early days of the war, with the U.S. pledging its full support for Israel. And the U.S., the American president, has grown increasingly frustrated with the way Israel is waging the war, with the fact that, you know, there are things like looming famine in Gaza now. Aid has really been trickling in, but it's just a drop in the ocean. The U.S. frustrated with the amount of civilian casualties in Gaza as well. So the White House says that the two leaders did speak about efforts to get more aid into Gaza. We know the White House is also deeply concerned about Israel's planned invasion of Rafah.
Our view is that there are ways for Israel to prevail in this conflict, to secure its long-term future, to end the terror threat from Gaza and not smash into Rafah.
Interestingly, the Israeli prime minister did not mention any of that when he talked about their conversation. He said they talked about the latest developments in the war, including Israel's commitment to achieving all the goals of the war.
Yeah, you can really almost see that growing divide just in how the two leaders described their conversation. Inez, thanks so much for being there for us.
Thank you.
Okay, one more quick break, but when we come back, what's behind a new push for federal paid leave? One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. Exactly 4 years ago, when the COVID-19 pandemic was upending our lives, including the way that we worked, there was a wave of momentum to pass a federal paid leave policy.
We need help with paid family leave and paid sick leave. Workers need it.
You can't ask a mom with a newborn baby to be at work in order to pay her rent.
After all, workers were forced to stay home when they were exposed to COVID. And yet, many of those workers, when they stayed home, had to forgo their paychecks. It became glaringly obvious that the United States is the only advanced economy in the entire world that doesn't offer paid leave. That means that there's no federal law that requires workers to keep getting paid if they need to take time off when they're sick or if they have a baby.
You know, I've been saying often, particularly since the pandemic, paid leave is about our common humanity.
That's Dawn Hucklebridge, the director of Paid Leave for All. She organized a campaign where more than 70 small businesses nationwide closed their doors yesterday to promote federal paid medical and family leave.
We know it is a tool for public health. We know it is a tool for economic growth and for families' economic security. And we know it is a tool for racial and gender equity.
So why exactly did that momentum for paid leave after COVID stall? Well, one explanation could be the price tag. The House actually passed a bill in 2021 that would have guaranteed 4 weeks of paid leave. It was ultimately blocked in the Senate when Senator Joe Manchin took issue with how much it could cost small businesses.
Paid leave, I think, should not be in this piece of legislation. I've been very clear.
That's one reason why some small business owners like Manju Dawkins are now speaking out.
My hope is that hopefully we small businesses don't have to take on the onus forever.
She says a federal paid leave policy is just plain good business. It sends a message to your employees that you actually care about more than just the work they do, which ultimately makes workers more loyal and productive.
It's good for society. It's good for families. It's good for businesses. And it's good for public health.
Government data shows that only 27% of U.S. workers had access to paid leave benefits through their employers last year. Still a long way to go before universal paid leave becomes anything close to universal. Hey, thanks so much for hanging with me today and yesterday. You can get more on all of these stories on abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Elizabeth Schulze. Brad is back tomorrow. I'll catch you next time.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.